Radio City it is on popdose.com. John Grayson here with you. Rob Ross here with you as well. And of course, you can find Rob's work all over the place on Popdose. Interviews and reviews of new records and even more. So, Rob, how's everything going this week?
As always, John, it's going. So
that's all we can expect.
Still here.
That's right.
Yes, indeed.
As long as that keeps up, everything is cool. And we've got a bunch to go over today. And we're going to start, and we usually wait until a little bit farther into the conversation to talk about some of these. But we have had so many legendary sad goodbyes and fond farewells that have happened over the last couple of days since you and I last talked. And first and foremost among them is the guy who had a bigger hand, I think, in inventing what rock and roll became than really anybody else who ever picked up a guitar. Chuck Berry died.
90 years old. God bless him.
Yeah.
He was the father of rock and roll. I mean, he is the quintessential rock and roll guitar player. You know, Scotty Moore aside, Chuck Berry was the all and everything for rock and roll guitarists.
Yeah.
Every guitar player in his wake tried to be him. It doesn't matter who they were, they tried to be him. And certainly, without Chuck Berry, there would be no Beatles. There would definitely be no Rolling Stones. There would be no... I don't feel there would be... and Eric Clapton, because if you go back and listen to something like Five Live Yardbirds and you hear the opening cut, Too Much Monkey Business, which was a Chuck Berry track, you know, that says it all right there. But without Chuck Berry, none of us would be here.
Yeah.
And that's not an overstatement either. That's just a fact. But 90 years old, and he left us a legacy that will carry on, I pray, from our generation when we're gone into the next one and into infinity.
Yeah.
That's all you can hope for, because... without Chuck Berry, there is no rock and roll.
And he also performed so long. And this is something that for people, I'm in the St. Louis, Missouri area. And for people here in town, we knew and we were used to it that every, I think it was the third Wednesday of every month at Blueberry Hill, which is a legendary bar and concert establishment here in town. Chuck Berry would be there and would play a show, and it did so well into his 80s, and it was quality. I mean, I saw him, I think, when he was 82, and at one of those shows at the Duck Room at Blueberry Hill, he was absolutely fantastic, just tore it up and did what you do in rock and roll. He left the crowd wanting more.
You know, I was lucky enough to see him. My parents took me to one of those rock and roll revival shows.
Yeah.
I think it was like the latter half of the 70s. So I saw him when he was already in his 50s. But, you know, the fact that, you know, back then he still had the firepower. He brought it, and he brought it hard and heavy. And I had never really been, quote, into Chuck Berry before that. I was more into Elvis Presley and Buddy Holly and the Everly Brothers. But Chuck Berry just brought a completely different... I think that might have been unconsciously where I first started to seriously think about what it would be like to actually play the guitar.
Yeah. Yeah, and to do so in front of a crowd and all of that, and the attitude that he brought with it, inventing the duck walk and all of that, he showed everybody what it meant to be a rock and roll showman, and for that, we are eternally grateful to him. Also, that we lost this week, in fact, just over the last day or so, a legendary columnist for the New York Daily News, and I'm just going to hand you, as a New Yorker, the name Jimmy Breslin and let you go.
Well, what can you say except he was the god of all New York journalists and writers? Him and Pete Hamill, you know, one versus the other, they're completely ingrained together. You know, without Breslin's almost desk pounding fury and wordsmithing, he knew what he was talking about. He didn't suffer fools gladly. He pulled no punches. He was a writer of and from the gut, and we've lost so much of that in journalism in general, which I'm sure is nothing new to anyone.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've lost what we've lost in Chuck Berry, we've lost in Jimmy Breslin now. You know, the idea of what a real hard-nosed, investigative, and thinking reporter is. Or was.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And so, again, sad goodbye to him. And one more fond farewell, and this one comes from the blues world, and a guy who, again, you talk about a showman. When you can sit in a chair, sing a song, and play the harmonica, and hold a crowd in your hand, that's some talent. And James Cotton did exactly that. James Cotton also lived well into, I believe he was 81 years old when he died. So Jimmy Breslin at 88, and we have Chuck Berry at age 90, and now James Cotton at age 81.
Yeah, I mean, it's just been a plethora of the true old guard leaving. Now, I will say this much, at least thank God we had them for a long time.
Yes.
It's never easy, but at least they lived good, long, cherished, and by and large successful lives. So for that, we can all be grateful and look to them as an extending influence. Like I said, going forward, long past us.
Indeed. Yes, those names will burn in history, no doubt about it. And again, Rob Ross, John Grayson here with you. You're listening to Radio City on PopDose.com. We've got some new stuff to talk about as well, and an interview that you did with another fairly new artist. Tell us a little bit about Denny Bonet and how the two of you got to sit down for a while.
Well, I've known Denny now for about 7 years, thankfully, and she's just an incredibly wonderful person. Never mind the fact that she is just one of the most electrifying performers I've ever seen. She's a violinist, you know, a classical violinist who can rock like nobody's business. But we actually started our initial conversation to do this interview during the summer of 2013. And of course, in the middle of the conversation, my tape recorder went snafu. So naturally, we had to bag it, even though the conversation itself was magnificent. But she's just a great person. And, you know, it was just on the heels of her then newest album, It's All Good, which I put up on PopDose as it was. And now it gets to the point where she was doing a new album called Bright Shiny Objects. And it was going to be an all-instrumental album, which it doesn't matter what genre you're working in. Instrumental albums are hard to pull off, hard to push, hard to sell, hard to get people to wrap their minds around.
Yep.
But yet, with this record, I think this one, first of all, I think I enjoy this one even more than It's All Good, which was just a masterpiece of a pop album. But you get to hear her virtuoso playing. You know, we're talking about somebody who plays like Itzhak Perlman meets AC/DC. I think that's the best way to really phrase it. And I hope that's not offensive to anyone, because it's not meant to be. She's just such a God-given talent. I mean, she makes the violin explode with emotion and feel, so you don't, in the end, miss vocals. Thing is that with this record, she was very clear in what her intentions were. She mapped this out, and she told me how she wanted to go about doing it, when she was going to do it. And I'm very thankful of the fact that, you know, she was kind enough to let me hear it. I would say it's been already almost a year since she first started putting it together. And the one thing that is important about this record is the fact that, yes, the violin is a highly emotionally wrenching instrument.
Yeah.
But this is a very happy, joyful, upbeat record. I mean, it's intense and it's melodic, obviously, as all get out. But the thing is, you feel really good listening to it. You know, it stays with you.
You know, I'm always interested to hear from somebody who conducts an interview with somebody that they've known for a while. Did you get anything new out of the interview? I mean, did you learn anything about her that you didn't know already?
Not really, simply because we've had the depth of conversation in the past that, you know, so I know her history and I know, you know, what her influences are and some of the people that she's worked with. And when I tell you, it is a literal cornucopia of talent. You know, you want to start with people like Warren Zevon as being one of her first gigs.
Yeah.
And then work your way down the list from there, like, oh, let's say R.E.M. Or how I met her, through Richard Barone, because she was playing on stage with him at one of the shows he did at Joe's Pub in New York City back in 2010, I believe it was,
okay,
when we first met. But the list is endless. I mean, she just came off of a tour with Cyndi Lauper. You know, so when I tell you, they're there. The names are there. It's just, I mean, okay, let's throw some names out. Okay, just for laughs, all right? Sarah McLachlan, Chris Whitley, Daniel Lanois, Sean Colvin, Richard Thompson, Alan Toussaint. Need I say more?
No, I think that's plenty. So
plus the aforementioned that I already told you about. You
right.
know, these are the people that she's in demand, and rightly so, because she's just that talented. Never mind the fact that she's just such a lovely person to, I can only imagine, working with.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had the good fortune of talking to her and interviewing her, and you know, she is, I consider her a friend and someone who, if you want to work with an incredibly gifted musician, this is the person you call, especially somebody, you know, who can play violin like I said, like nobody's business.
There you go. So check it out. It's the interview with Denny Bonet, and it's up on popdose.com, elsewhere on the website. We also have an interview that one of your colleagues conducted. Justin Vellucci got to sit down with a guy. You know, there are hard luck stories in rock and roll, and there are stories of perseverance even after getting smacked down again and again. And a lot of times it's entire bands who go through that. He got to sit down and talk to a guy who lost his band, and that was the entry into rock and roll superstardom. Who did he talk to?
Chuck Mosley, who was the original lead singer of Faith No More. Now, funnily enough, I was never a fan of Faith No More.
Uh-huh.
Certainly not during the Mike Patton era. That was part of a sound that at the time really didn't appeal to me. It was, you know, the Faith No Mores and Jane's Addictions and so on of the world, that it just wasn't my thing. Now I'm talking in perspective, I hope. You know, so I really didn't pay any attention to them, but I sure as fuck remember all too well We Care a Lot, which was the entry point, if you will, for Faith No More, and that was Chuck Mosley, because it was a catchy song.
Right.
I mean, it really was. It used to get a lot of airplay on the old WHTG 106.3 from Eatontown, New Jersey, which was the radio station we always listened to. And what was it? Well, we started listening to it in 1984 when we heard Husker Du's Reoccurring Dreams, which was the 14-minute psychedelic backwards magnum opus of insanity. But I think that song appeared around 88 or 89, and we used to hear it always in rotation. And, you know, it could drive you crackers. But the thing is it was catchy. So once ingrained in your head, it never got out. So I know nothing about Chuck Mosley, and I thought Justin's interview was absolutely terrific because it gave me a slight insight into somebody who I just don't know anything of. And I have to say, from the way he came off in the interview, Mr. Mosley is definitely a man with a sense of grounding and perspective. He's been through hell.
Yep.
And
several
he's
times.
Come through it. Yeah, and the thing is, he's gone through things that so many people, you know, couldn't even begin to fathom in their wildest dreams. And he's come through it with a sense of, I don't want to say humbling, but he certainly knows now what he didn't then. And I think a lot of people could take a lesson from that kind of perspective and I hate to say it, hard-gained wisdom.
Yeah. Well, you look at how many people in similar situations to his died, whether by their own hand or through drugs, or just shut the door, just quit the business and went off and sold real estate. You know what I mean?
It's true. And the thing is that, you know, it's nice to see that he still has a little bit of the proverbial fire burning in
right.
him to want to keep doing this. You know, I mean, certainly, if that were me, I probably wouldn't entertain the idea because of knowing the pitfalls and the pain, the emotional strain, the psychological strain. Never mind what it can do to you physically, financially. It's a credit to him to have the depth and thoughtfulness, certainly to what he brought to this interview. And I thought Justin's questions were absolutely on the mark.
Definitely.
So he didn't pull any punches. Justin didn't pull any punches with the questions, and Mr. Mosley did not pull any punches with his responses.
Yeah.
So I give both of them full marks for something that I found really informative, because like I said, I know nothing about him. So to gain a little insight is very helpful. And
indeed.
This is why you do it, and this is why you read these things.
Exactly. So go check it out. And we're going to do one more shameless plug for something that's elsewhere on Popdose, because you and I have both been listening into Dave Metzger do Dizzy Heights and bring us back into a lot of times some music that we haven't heard in a while. And he's got another one up that took a decidedly progressive direction. What's he got for us this week?
Well, that's the interesting thing. This one is, you know, and it's by way of another Popdose brother. Ted. So, you know, Ted asking David to quote, play a melodic pop/prog set.
Which, again, is not normally his wheelhouse. However.
But yet, somehow, he makes it. You know what it is? When you have the know-how, when you have the love of what you're doing, you find a way to weave it together. You put that thread in and hope it holds up as you're stitching it. And sure enough, David did it. Now, I have never claimed to know the band Muse from Shinola.
Yeah.
Okay. But then you have Rush in the mix, the band Saga. Do you remember Saga?
I mean, that's vaguely, a name. Vaguely,
yeah. Yeah, from another lifetime.
Right.
But then he ties in the Smiths, who I have my moments with them, I have to admit. There are some songs that I like, and then there are moments that I just think, what the fuck were people thinking with
right.
the band? I
mean, really, what is this thing?
The worship. And then Blue Oyster Cult. Now, of course, you and I in our kidhoods, we loved Blue Oyster Cult, aka Soft White Underbelly.
But I never in a million years would have considered them prog. I mean, they were another hard rock band, you know, a capable one, but that's really it. And I never really thought of them doing anything particularly progressive.
Did I lose you? Well, here's my deeply pensive thought on that. One word will, I think, help aid the argument, if you will, of the cult being in that proggy vein. Keyboards.
Right. True enough. And the one song that they had, as a matter of fact, on the Heavy Metal soundtrack, which is one of my favorite movies of all time, Veteran of Psychic Wars, was very much a keyboard-driven song. So I guess, sure.
If they were a heavier prog band, how's that?
That works,
Does
definitely.
That work? I mean, every now and then, you got to fuck with the formula a little bit.
Exactly.
And I think this is one of those moments. But I mean, look, you know, there was some you know, would you say the Edgar Winter Group was prog or heavy? You know?
Right.
I mean, keyboards, but they were heavy. So, and notice Columbia Records, not a plug, just I'm just saying, they were label mates at the same time, you know? Around the time that Agents of Fortune was out,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Right.
But Agents of Fortune, you know, that's, I mean, what do you say? Do you call it rock or do you call it progressive? I call that progressive rock in the true sense of rock.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. So, I mean, the lines of demarcation, the labels and all of the other shit that goes along with it, it's all made up babble anyway. But Dave did get a really good Dizzy Heights podcast out of it. So go listen to that and you'll hear some music that you might not have heard the tie in the first time, but on a re-listen, while they're all next to each other, you'll definitely get the thread. So that's elsewhere.
And listen to him talking about it. That's
yes.
the key component.
Right. So definitely check out what Dave's got for you in Dizzy Heights this week. Now, on that front, we have a number of other things going, and a few weeks ago, we decided to just add a new feature into this broadcast called In Our Heads, and that's really what it is. It's whatever's been in our heads this week as an early influence, as a re-listen, as something that just kind of popped up out of nowhere, and mine last week was Basketball Jones from Cheech and Chong, and you never know where this stuff is going to come from, but I gave you, Rob, an idea for this week of that first 45 that you wore the grooves off. The first is a little kid that you had this record and you thought, I love this thing so much, and you played it till it just wouldn't play anymore.
There are four of them because I got them all simultaneously
okay.
as a little kid. And I'm talking about literally as a toddler because I just loved them so much.
Yeah.
And they are, in no particular order, Yellow Submarine, Eleanor Rigby.
Yep, had it.
Strawberry Fields Forever, Penny Lane.
Yeah.
I'm a Believer, Not Your Stepping Stone.
I'm not your stepping stone. I'm not your stepping stone.
Daydream Believer, Going Down.
Excellent.
Now, those are my first four 45s. Did I play them incessantly? You better believe it. I'm probably my little Fisher-Price record player. the first Monkees album and Revolver.
Yeah.
Albeit the American version. But the first Monkees album that my aunt had given to me so generously as a like I said, literally a toddler. You know, I played that thing. There isn't an element to that particular record that I don't know inside, outside, backwards, forwards, upside down, and in any other permutation. I mean, those four singles and that album were my foundation to everything.
You could do worse.
Sure. I mean, of course, being a product of the 60s, you know, that's, you know, what can you say? I mean,
you had very cool parents.
Now, I will say this much, though. I will say this much in a lot of fairness. You when you leap forward to those, the more astute listening, instead of having mommy buy you this 45 or that 45 every time she went to Corvettes or Grants or whatever store she happened to be in.
Yeah.
And you always wound up getting the singles that were either already cut out in the little old, if you remember them, the plastic bag without the paper sleeve that just said Golden Hits, you know, 25 cents, and they were a quarter, and there was a little hole punched in it. I'm not counting those. I'm talking about being cognizant of hearing something on the radio and basically getting hard from it as a child, you know. That's a completely different head. Now, for something like that, I can tell you immediately, the big three for me definitely took place when I was about 8, and that was Crocodile Rock, back with Elderberry Wine.
Yep.
Jet, back with Mamounia.
Oh, yeah.
And Will It Go Round in Circles by Billy Preston, back with his version of Blackbird.
Yeah, again, great taste in music and great choices all the way around, especially for a kid. Now, for me, I had two of them, and one of them was something I stole from my sister. You talked about getting those the records that had the label that just said Golden Hits on them or whatever. Well, there was also, at the time, a thing that you could send away for, and it was a Box Tops deal, and what happened is you would send away for a record, and when you got it, it came in a cardboard tube, and when you pulled it out, it was a square. It was a very thin plastic square that was so thin it could roll up. You remember what I'm talking about?
Yes, indeed. I do, because they had those going into the 80s. I actually have, not to get away from you, but there used to be a British magazine called Flexi Pop, and Flexi Pop had whoever was on the cover. They had Bauhaus.
Right.
You know, and I still have in my collection to this day, I still have Nick Hayward's demo version of Nobody's Fool for Haircut 100 and two tracks from The Jam, Pop Art Poem, and their original version. I think it's Paul Weller's demo of Boy About Town, which I actually prefer to the sound effects version because it's a little richer.
Right.
So, you know, I still have those. But even beyond that, you said box tops. Do you remember actually getting records on the back of cereal boxes?
Yes, right. And that was the other way that you could get them that didn't have to go to the record store for, is they would be printed on the back and you'd have to cut them out of the back of the cereal box. And then you could play them on the record player. They were great.
Post cereals had them. I actually had two of them from, of course, my beloved Monkees.
Yeah. Right, and my sister had the Monkees ones, and the one that I stole from her, the roll-up, was Red Rubber Ball by The Circle, and that thing, it didn't take long to wear that thing out because they were so thin, the plastic was, but I found out much later on, that is a record that has an interesting past to it, because it goes...
Paul Simon wrote it?
Right, it goes through Paul Simon, the Beatles were somewhat involved in putting that band together. In fact, John Lennon was the one who told them to change the name from Circle, C-I-R-C-L-E, to Circle, C-Y-R-K-L-E.
Like the Birds with the B-Y-R-D-S. And, of course, they were half-managed by Brian Epstein.
Yep, exactly. So, yeah, you know, as goofy a pop song as it is, it's very capable, and it was catchy as hell. But the other one, the first one that I had that I wore the grooves off of, that it was a real vinyl 45, on the old Columbia label that had the Pac-Man-looking C and was red on the bottom, grated into orange on the top, was the cover of Rolling Stone by Dr. Hook and the Medicine Show. Now,
that's a song that I remember hearing on AM radio as a kid. And that was the thing. We grew up with AM radio.
Yep.
We grew up with hits on AM radio.
Right.
And, you know, that's funny. That's the early 70s changeover label for Columbia.
Yeah.
Because the original Columbia label was just the red label, and it said Columbia on top, and it had the name of the band or performer on the side.
Right. But this one had it on the bottom, the way that it was, early 70s style. But see, that song, and again, as goofy as it was, has a kind of anarchic quality that was the reason why my parents got me that is because it was the first song that I ever heard on the radio that made me laugh. And it did so because it had that, everybody was just sitting around and it was just this loose feel, like a bunch of guys that had been drinking all day at a party and were sitting on somebody's back porch. And the things that it had to say about the incoming corporate rock world that hadn't even really hit yet, it was incisive and biting. I didn't get that until way later on, but still listening to it as a kid, I thought, that's funny. That's what rock and roll, that's the legend of rock and roll.
We got a lot of little teenage blue-eyed groupies who'll do anything we say. We got a genuine Indian guru. He's teaching us a better way. We got all the friends that money can buy, so we never have to be alone. And we keep getting richer, but we can't get our picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
It really, truly, you've just hit it right on the head. First of all, it's a completely freewheeling, almost improv kind of song.
Yes.
That's just, you know, it's almost like if the Lovin' Spoonful had been so drunk and somebody put up a couple of microphones around them, you know,
right.
Because good time jug band music, but, you know, it takes all kind of thrills and takes all kind of pills, you know, that those lyrics are just completely over the top for the time. But
right.
The thing is, incisive and biting, yeah, because it was also foretelling of what was about to be, because all of a sudden you went in the, and I'm going to paraphrase someone I know of here, It tells of what was about to become the overblownness of heaviosity.
Yes.
That became rock music, I would say, around 73 or so, you know, and, you know, suddenly you had the Rolling Stones on these massive tours and ELP coming to the forefront. And
that was also the year that Houses of the Holy came out.
You know, and of course, Zeppelin with the, you know, cock rock kind of mentality.
Right.
And then, you know, Paul McCartney and Wings really put it all into, I hate to say it, but into a really sickeningly oversweet combination of playing. Well, I mean, look, Wings was my first concert, and I'm not going to deny my absolute love for them, but, you know, you look back on it, and it's so over the top and so kitschy and, you know, with the light shows and all that, and then ELO, and it just, the progression or regression of the way rock turned out, it's no wonder why punk had to happen.
Yeah.
You had to strip it all down and bring it right back to its most base element, go back to the clubs and just, you know, three or four schmucks or whatever it is, get up on stage and play the fucking music without any cutiness, you know, and whether or not you're a virtuoso doesn't matter. But, you know, Cover of the Rolling Stone was a really, really, it's a very powerful song when you look at it in hindsight, because what was everybody's goal? To get on the cover of the Rolling Stone. Once
right.
You did that, your career was, you thought, made. Well, how many people got on the cover of Rolling Stone and went as quickly to hell as they found out the hard way? I'd say there's more of those than ones who could sustain.
Right. But as long as you still had the little teenage blue-eyed groupies who do anything you say, I think it's all right. So that's our In Our Heads for this week. Again, John Grayson, Rob Ross here with you on Radio City on Poptos. And we've got a couple more things to go over this week, as we've done everything kind of backwards today on the podcast. We've got some new music to talk over and a band that you have the review up online for a new single and a new album by the same name. And the band is called The Flywheels. Tell us a little bit about them.
Well, this is almost, it's a little bit of a sad story. Not a little bit, it's actually a very sad story. The Flywheels have been around apparently for about 20 years now in San Francisco. You know, they're kind of like a neo-psychedelic garage power pop band. And they're really they're driven by a duo, singer Kim Wunderlie and bass player Eric Scott. And unfortunately, Eric Scott passed away in 2016. So he didn't live to see this debut album actually physically appear. And that makes it a very, very, right there, it makes it very melancholic. But, you know, the bottom line is, with or without him, this album is absolutely stupendous. You know, it's got all the right elements of what you and I and most people love about that combination of power pop and neo-psychedelia and garage rock. You know, when you put all of it together and you know how to do it and the way to do it and when to do it or where to make interesting turns in the arrangements, this band really has something to offer.
Yeah.
You know, there's Beatle elements. Case in point, the opening track, Hello Crew World, ironically titled. You know, it's got a Taxman kind of riff, but it's got dirtier sounding guitars, you know, and harmonies and very much that neo-psychedelia. But then there's another track called Diamond From Your Mouth that has these very intricate time signatures. You know, it's got a real, it's got that almost experimental Spirit of Sex 67 kind of vibe.
Right. Okay.
What I mean with that, that kind of, when bands would try things like a little waltz signature in the middle of the song to just totally throw you off.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Then there's a piece like Let Me Take You Down to the Sea, which is a ballad, but it's kind of psychedelic, but to me, when I listen to it, because it's a very melancholic kind of track, it's got, first of all, incredibly emotional vocals on it. Kim Wunderlich is a fantastic singer. But in the arrangements and the dynamics of the harmonies, I hear a lot of the things that came off of side two of Abbey Road, you know, where the Beatles just reached that absolute apex of perfection. And mind you, Abbey Road's an album I never cared for. But, you know, you listen to things like Because and Sun King and the harmonies, you know, that it's almost like a chorale is behind her.
Yep.
You know, it's just this wonderful, almost orchestrated sound of voices. It's just a beautiful, touching piece. So when you put all those elements together, this is an album that absolutely works, and it's one of those records that, like so many I've been fortunate enough to hear in this last couple of years, it just goes into you. And it stays with you, and you want to let people know about it.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned her vocal skills as well, because she is very well aware of how to use her voice. It's like she has fun doing different things. And in the track that's linked, the video that's linked on the page with your review of I'm for the Flowers is the song I'm for the Flowers, which starts out with this almost Big Brother and the Holding Company kind of shriek, and then goes into a much more Pretenders-y kind of sound. And she makes the transition like that, and it's credible. It works.
Right. This is feel. This is not premeditated. And that's what I like about it. You know, it's that natural, organic sense of this is what's going to work for the song.
Exactly.
You know, she doesn't push into realms that she doesn't need to go into. But just the overall skill and the melodicism and the raw gut emotion of this record, you can feel it. You can definitely feel it. And, you know, that does bring me to the next topic, because we're talking about something that's melancholic, such as, you know, the passing of Mr. Scott. But Friday we were reminded that it is 7 years to the day that we lost certainly one of my heroes, Alex Chilton.
Yeah.
And ironically, this was also South by Southwest week, and there was a performance of Big Star's Third done at South by Southwest as a sort of taster for the forthcoming DVD of the concerts that you and I have talked about over the years. And, it's nice to know that, A, they still have it, probably even more so now because they've taken a little time away from it, but they still played it with such love and care and attention to detail and passion. And from all reports, the concert itself was magnificent. The fact that it was on the anniversary of Alex's passing, it makes it even more poignant. I mean, I spent most of Friday listening to the Box Tops. I don't think I could have handled Big Star emotionally.
Yeah. No, I completely get it. And, you know, going back to the Box Top stuff, I mean, that to see that transition from one to the other, again, it showed off just an incredible amount of talent. So, I mean, is there still at this point for you what you would consider to be the song that represents his pinnacle?
Do you mean with the Box Tops or with Big Star? Or
anywhere along the career.
The Ballad of El Goodo.
Okay.
That's Alex Chilton at his finest.
Yeah.
No question about it. I mean, you know, from the personal perspective, because it's my favorite song, When My Baby's Beside Me. But, I mean, you just listen to the words and the melody, the structure, the execution of the Ballad of El Goodo. That song is just, it's otherworldly. It is powerful. It is timeless. It is poignant. It is emotional. It is everything, you know. And of course, when the harmonies kick in, it makes you want to weep. There's so much to be said just about that one track alone. I mean, Alex Chilton was a God-given talent, and I'm not discrediting Chris Bell, because Chris Bell, of course, was the other half of what made Big Star so special and perfect. But you look at just some of the other things that Alex Chilton did. You know, let's talk about with the Box Tops. No, he didn't write it, but listen to that. What was he, 16 years old?
Yeah.
That gravelly-voiced kid who delivered the letter?
Right.
I mean, my God. You know, and that's a song that people to this day still sing, cover, listen to, sing along with. It doesn't matter. Soul Deep, which is another one of the Box Tops masterpieces. You know, you go to that first, now forgotten, but released well after the fact, solo album that didn't come out when it should have. It's now called 1970, but, you know, songs like Free Again or Just to See You, you know, or you know, of course, as far as Big Star goes, you know, another one of his absolute triumphs, Back of a Car and Daisy Glaze and September Girls, or even from the solo years, which people found a little harder to digest, and I understand it because Alex Chilton was an artist first and foremost, and he didn't look back. He wasn't one to revisit his past, if barely ever, if ever, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You listen to a solo track which I think is my personal favorite is Bangkok, which is just clever and wild and rollicking and controlled insanity. But absolutely genius. Alex Chilton was a gift to us all. And, you know, his passing, you know, it still bites at me, as do several.
Yeah.
But this one especially.
Yeah, I hear you. And there's so much more that can be said about his career. But the best way to do it, of course, is to do exactly what Rob just said. Go back and revisit the music. That's him talking right into your ear. And we head into the political realm this week just for a couple of minutes because that's about all we can stand at this point. I mean, it's so bad. You look around at what's happening in the state of this, and it is just every bit of what's happening in the United States government right now is pure insanity. And while everybody is focused on the latest, you know, gotcha moment over the, you know, was he wiretapped or was he not wiretapped, there are so many more important things that are going on. And you have to wonder again if this is all by design, if we're supposed to be watching this while the sleight of hand is going on and we're watching our parents have their meals on wheels taken away from them.
Well, that's the part that I find most distressing, because I do think it is the sleight of hand, and I think people have gotten wind of this. You know, pay attention to this while I sneak this in the side door.
Right.
You know, that's how I'm looking at it. You know, the cutting of Meals on Wheels is just beyond my comprehension, so I don't even think I can really expound upon it, because what can you say? This is something that people survive on. We're talking about surviving.
Right, right.
We're not talking about a bonus or something to as a pleasantry. We're talking about survival. Subsequently, the whole question of this new health care plan is just that. It's a question. I mean, look, I have to be honest. I've looked through Obamacare, and it is difficult for anyone to afford it. You know, if you don't have medical coverage, it's inconceivable to me how, when you have little to no money, how you can afford $800 a month to and upward to try and cover a family.
Right.
So right there, it's a flawed system to begin with, and it needs to be addressed, and it needs to be addressed quickly. But having said that, there are people out there who are just getting by with it and on it. Now, on the negative side, Obamacare itself has made the cost of medications skyrocket in a way that I find inconceivable.
Yeah.
I thank God that I'm not on any kind of medications, because if it were, I'd either be dead or would be very ill, because I certainly couldn't afford it. Now, you know, getting away from the notion of Obamacare itself, but talking about what they're trying to implement, what are they trying to do? There's no clarity here. You know, is it making it a case of an a la carte system where you can actually shop for what you need and can afford? Is that what they want to do? Do they want to make this feasible for people who cannot afford healthcare? How much, and I'm using the word in quotation marks, quality will you find in this idea of the Republicans' plan for healthcare? I mean, these are questions that need to be addressed. I don't think I'm off the mark, and I don't think I'm being party political here, but it's a common sense question that affects all. And I don't care what your political stance is. if you have a need, you deserve to see a doctor, and you should be able to not go bankrupt for it.
Right.
God forbid you have that need.
Well, yeah, and you think about it, if you go a step farther with that, and this is, you know, the Republicans were the ones who floated the bullshit about death panels, and yet when you talk about an a la carte healthcare system, then there's got to be somebody who has to sit there and decide whether it's something you need or something you just want to feel better, you know? And so it's just, it's crazy, but there doesn't seem to be anybody that's coming at it from the standpoint that the doctors do, which is, I want my patients to feel better. I want my patients to be better. And it needs to start from that standpoint, and then we'll deal with the money later on. And nobody wants to deal with that. So unfortunately, it seems that it's in the hands of the wrong bunch of people. And by that, I don't mean Republicans. I mean politicians in general. So like you said, screw-ups galore all over the place before we started monkeying around with it. So it just doesn't look like it's going to get any better anytime soon. But, you know, the mantra has been the same, and it will stay the same until they start doing their jobs, which is, where is the press on this?
Well, that's a completely different kettle of fish because, you know, we saw this week the, and I'm sorry, I'm probably going to offend people by saying this, the Al Capone's vault buildup of
Rachel Maddow
saying that she had Donald Trump's tax returns. Now, I understand fully that she's trying to connect the dots one by one, and that's admirable. But the way it was presented,
the with countdown
that,
clock.
That was just, it was a big red herring. It was, once again, the emperor's new clothes. And frankly, it made her and MSNBC look very bad. It made them look foolish. It made them look incredibly opportunistic. My gut instinct on first hearing it and seeing it was, this is the kind of thing that Fox would do.
Yep. Right. And it's just, you know, as much bullshit. Exactly.
Right. And the fact is, okay, it was a 2005 return. How did it suddenly appear? You know, that's my first question. You know, this investigative reporter apparently received it. You know, how did he get it? Is it something that Donald Trump's people, by virtue of Donald Trump saying, go do this, sent to this report?
Right.
I mean, he is notorious for doing his own PR. You know, we've heard the phone calls and messages that have been left under assumed names for, you know, Donald Trump's positive spins on things in the past. So is that something he, you know, he might be capable of doing even as president? Absolutely. So you have something like that, but you also have the press being so willing to do combat, but in a non-constructive way. They'll go into a back and forth with Sean Spicer rather than digging their heels in and really ferreting through things. You know, this whole thing with the wiretapping. Yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. Look, I am fairly certain that the press could do that, especially in this day and age. You know, Woodward and Bernstein did a pretty good job of, on their own, of ferreting out what the hell happened with Nixon and the Watergate break-in.
Right.
Am I wrong?
No, not at all.
I mean, and what sources did you have at your disposal back then? Or I should say resources, save for the cloak and dagger meetings with Deep Throat.
Right.
Not much.
That was it.
You know, you have everything now, every possible means of gathering information, information that matters, information that is crucial, and they're not doing their homework. Is it laziness? Is it fear?
Yeah,
what is it?
I don't know, and I wish I did, because on that front, you had, even on this business about you know, whether or not he was wiretapped, which of course he wasn't. I mean, there's zero evidence at all. And now you have the surrogates come out and they say, well, you're asking for proof. No, we're asking for evidence, and there isn't any. And nobody's asking for slam dunk proof of anything. All we want is there evidence at all that would dictate investigating this shit? And no, there isn't. So, and there hasn't been. So what happens? Well, President Trump points up, oh, I hate saying that, President Trump points up this New York Times January 20th article, and he said it five times, and then Sean Sphincter repeated it five times, and then the rest of them repeated it ten times, and they all keep saying, well, on January 20th, the New York Times said Trump Tower was wiretapped, and not a single time did CNN or MSNBC or anybody go back and read that article from January 20th, which does not at all in any way say that Trump Tower was wiretapped. All it would take is one of them to go, and we read that article, and what they just said was horse shit.
There you go.
And
you know,
they
it's very clear.
Yeah.
Are they asleep at the wheel?
Yeah.
Is this willful? Is this part of a whole bigger, I don't want to sound like some kind of conspiracy theorist nut because I'm not, but is this part of a whole bigger scheme between everybody, kind of a nudge-nudge, wink-wink scenario?
Yeah.
Is there a punchline that none of us are aware of, or we're being definitely kept in the dark? I mean, it's very, very distressing. And to be honest with you, I tend now more to not watch the news like I used to. You know, I just want to know what's happening locally,
mm-hmm.
what's happening in my area, what's happening in my city. Yeah, national headlines are important, but I don't sit there and I don't listen to the pundits like I did with the almost religious fervor like I did. I don't watch Morning Joe any longer. I don't watch Rachel Maddow. I may occasionally tune in to Lawrence O'Donnell because he's one of the few voices of reason. And he doesn't shout or browbeat you when
right.
he's on the air.
Right.
You know, he makes his point, he makes it salient, and he makes it very clear cut so that even the layman like me can understand it with absolute clarity.
Yeah.
You know, but I can't find any comfort in anything I hear from the media.
Mm-mm.
I don't trust the news media right now.
Yeah.
And I have to say that by virtue of Rachel Maddow's overzealousness in presenting the 2005 tax fragment that she did present, it just gave more credence to fake news, really.
Yeah. Oh, and it did was make
Trump
him look good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. What did it say? It said he paid his taxes. Okay. So, yeah, on we go. But that'll give us plenty to look over. Of course, we'll have another week's worth of this to go over next time we get together. Anything else we should be watching for in your columns on Popdos?
Yeah, there are a whole bunch of album reviews that I have coming up, and new videos that are out there. Brand new video from The Weaklings, another track off of Studio 2, which is a terrific album that
very
you and
good.
I talked about ages ago. Just a plethora of good things, and of course everybody's columns that you need to look at, whether it's G.W. Dunphy or Keith Crichton or Jack Furyk. Everybody on Popdos, get in there, read it, look it over, absorb it, dig it, you know, because that's why we do it.
Yeah.
You know, we do it because so you don't have to.
And the love is there. That's right. They'll do the crate digging for you.
That's the key component. It really is. It's a mission of love. And, you know, I can't emphasize enough how blessed and lucky I am to be part of this and have been for going on 4 years now. And, you know, as long as I'm still here, I'm going to keep doing it. And it's either that or watch sports. And right now we got a shit ton of sports to watch between March Madness, and we're coming up now on the very end of spring training, and the end of the NHL season. And I don't know how the Rangers are going to do because God knows they're awful at home and amazing on the road. They managed to win. So I give them nothing more nor less than a first round. They're going to go in and out in the first round, I think. The Mets are shaping up to be fairly good, you know, if everybody stays healthy, especially that pitching staff, because we've not made it through an entire season with those arms all intact. If we did, it's going to be hard to beat. Washington's going to be pretty hard-pressed. You know, we've got some really good bats. We've got a good seasoned team that I think is gelling with every passing day. I mean, they gelled. You know, the fact that they were so depleted by last year and still managed to squeak into the wild card made me very proud. So let's see what they can do healthy. And with March Madness, you know what? I got my mainstays. It's always Kentucky, Duke, and North Carolina. Any one of those three makes me happy.
There you go. And the fact that Wisconsin went out early just did my heart good as well. So we'll do some more talking about that next time. We'll have plenty more to go over. And in the meantime, thank you to everybody for listening in to Radio City this week. And we'll have some more for you next Tuesday. Rob Ross, always a pleasure, my man. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, brother. Be well. Congratulations on the first week of the new show being, you know, completely successful. And let's keep going.
You got it. And thank you for the plug there. And, of course, you can listen to me every weekday from 10 to noon Central Time on the Big 550 KTRS. Just go to ktrs.com for that. More on the way next time on Radio City. Go have some fun on popdose.com.